When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 1 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Inimitable Jeeves by P.G. Woodhouse. Chapter 1. Jeeves Exerts the Old Cerebellum.
"Morning, Jeeves," I said.
"Good morning, sir," said Jeeves.
He put the good old cup of tea softly on the table by my bed, and I took a refreshing sip. Just right as usual. Not too hot, not too sweet, not too weak, not too strong, not too much milk, and not a drop spilled in the saucer. A most amazing cove, Jeeves. So dashed competent in every respect. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I mean to say, take just one small instance. Every other valet I've ever had used to barge into my room in the morning while I was still asleep, causing much misery. But Jeeves seems to know when I'm awake by a sort of telepathy. He always floats in with the cup exactly 2 minutes after I come to life. Makes a deuce of a lot of difference to a fellow's day.
How's the weather, Jeeves?
Exceptionally clement, sir. Anything in the papers?
Some slight friction threatening the Balkan, sir. Otherwise, nothing.
I say, Jeeves, a man I met at the club last night told me to put my shirt on privateer for the 2 o'clock race this afternoon. How about it?
I should not advocate it, sir. The stable is not sanguine.
That was enough for me. Jeeves knows. How, I couldn't say, but he knows. There was a time when I would laugh lightly and go ahead and lose my little all against his advice, but not now.
Talking of shirts, I said, have those mauve ones I ordered arrived yet?
Yes, sir. I sent them back.
Sent them back?
Yes, sir. They would not have become you.
Well, I must say, I thought fairly highly of those shirtings, but I bowed to superior knowledge. Weak? I don't know. Most fellows, no doubt, are all for having their valets confine their activities to creasing trousers and what not, without trying to run the home. But it's different with Jeeves. Right from the first day he came to me, I have looked on him as a sort of guide, philosopher, and friend.
Mr. Little rang up on the telephone a few moments ago, sir. I informed him that you were not yet awake.
Did he leave a message?
No, sir. He mentioned that he had a matter of importance to discuss with you, but confided no details.
Oh, well, I expect I shall be seeing him at the club.
No doubt, sir.
I wasn't what you might call in a fever of impatience. Bingo Little is a chap I was at school with, and we see a lot of each other still. He's the nephew of old Mortimer Little, who retired from business recently with a goodish pile. You've probably heard of Little's liniment. It limbers up the legs.
Bingo biffs about London on a pretty comfortable allowance given him by his uncle, and leads, on the whole, a fairly unclouded life. It wasn't likely that anything which he described as a matter of importance would turn out to be really so frightfully important. I took it that he had discovered some new brand of cigarette which he wanted me to try or something like that, and didn't spoil my breakfast by worrying. After breakfast, I lit a cigarette and went to the open window to inspect the day. It certainly was one of the best and brightest.
"Jeeves," I said.
"Sir," said Jeeves. He had been clearing away the breakfast things, but at the sound of the young master's voice, cheesed it courteously. "You were absolutely right about the weather. It's a juicy morning.
"'Decidedly, sir.
"'Spring and all that?'
"'Yes, sir.
"'In the spring, Jeeves, a livelier iris gleams upon the burnished dove.
"'So I have been informed, sir.
"'Right-ho. Then bring me my wangy, my yellowest hues, and the old green Homburg. "'I'm going into the park to do pastoral dances.'
"'I don't know if you know that sort of feeling you get on these days "'round about the end of April and the beginning of May, "'when the sky's a light blue, with cotton-wool clouds, "'and there's a bit of breeze blowing from the west. "'Kind of uplifted feeling. "'Romantic, if you know what I mean. "'I'm not much of a ladies' man, but on this particular morning "'it seemed to me that what I really wanted "'was some charming girl to buzz up and ask me to save her from assassins or something.' So that it was a bit of an anti-climax when I merely ran into young Bingo Little, looking perfectly foul in a crimson satin tie decorated with horseshoes.
"'Hello, Bertie,' said Bingo.
"'My God, man,' I gargled. "'The cravat! The gent's neckwear! Why? For what reason?'
"'Oh, the tie?' he blushed. "'I was given it.'
He seemed embarrassed, so I dropped the subject. We toddled along a bit and sat down on a couple of chairs by the serpentine.
"'Jeeves tells me you want to talk to me about something,' I said.
"'Eh?' said Bingo with a start.
"'Oh, yes, yes, yes.'
I waited for him to unleash the topic of the day, but he didn't seem to want to get going. Conversation languished. He stared straight ahead of him in a glassy sort of manner.
"'I say, Bertie,' he said, after a pause of about an hour and a quarter.
"'Hello. Do you like the name Mabel?'
"'No.
No? No.
You don't think there's a kind of music in the word, like the wind rustling gently through the treetops?'
"'No.
He seemed disappointed for a moment, then cheered up.
"'Of course you wouldn't. You always were a fat-headed worm without any soul, weren't you?
Just as you say.' "'Who is she? Tell me all.'
For I realize now that poor old Bingo was going through it once again. Ever since I have known him, and we were at school together, he has been perpetually falling in love with someone, generally in the spring, which seems to act on him like magic. At school he had the finest collection of actresses' photographs of any one of his time, and at Oxford his romantic nature was a byword.
"'You'd better come along and meet her at lunch,' he said, looking at his watch.
"'A ripe suggestion,' I said. "'Where are you meeting her? At the Ritz?'
"'Near the Ritz.'
He was geographically accurate. About 50 yards east of the Ritz, there is one of those blighted tea and bun shops you see dotted about all over London, and into this, if you believe me, young Bingo dived like a homing rabbit. And before I had time to say a word, we were wedged in at a table— on the brink of a silent pool of coffee left there by an early luncher. I'm bound to say I couldn't quite follow the development of the scenario. Bingo, while not absolutely rolling in the stuff, has always had a fair amount of the ready. Apart from what he got from his uncle, I knew that he had finished up the jumping season well on the right side of the ledger. Why, then, was he lunching the girl at this godforsaken eatery? It couldn't be because he was hard up. Just then the waitress arrived, rather a pretty girl. "'Aren't we going to wait?' I started to say to Bingo, thinking it somewhat thick that, in addition to asking the girl to lunch with him in a place like this, he should fling himself on the foodstuffs before she turned up, when I caught sight of his face and stopped. The man was goggling. His entire map was suffused with a rich blush. He looked like the soul's awakening done in pink.'
"'Hello, Mabel,' he said with a sort of gulp.
"'Hello,' said the girl.
"'Mabel,' said Bingo, "'this is Bertie Wooster, a pal of mine. "'Pleased to meet you,' she said. "'Nice morning.'
"'Fine,' I said.
"'You see, I'm wearing the tie,' said Bingo.
"'It suits you beautiful,' said the girl. "'Personally, if anyone had told me that a tie like that suited me— I should have risen and struck them on the mazzard, regardless of their age and sex. But poor old Bingo simply got all flustered with gratification and smirked in the most gruesome manner.
"'Well, what's it going to be today?' asked the girl, introducing the business touch into the conversation.
Bingo studied the menu devoutly.
"I'll have a cup of cocoa, cold veal and ham pie, slice of fruitcake and a macaroon. Same for you, Bertie?"
I gazed at the man revolted. That he could have been a pal of mine all these years and think me capable of insulting the old Tom with this sort of stuff cut me to the quick.
"Or how about a bit of hot steak pudding with a sparkling Limeado to wash it down?" said Bingo.
You know, the way love can change a fellow is really frightful to contemplate. This chappie before me, who spoke in that absolutely careless way of macaroons and Limeado, was the man I had seen in happier days telling the head waiter at Claridge's exactly how he wanted the chef to prepare the sole frito gourmet au champignon and saying he would jolly well sling it back if it wasn't just right. Ghastly, ghastly.
A roll and butter and a small coffee seemed the only things on the list that hadn't been specially prepared by the nastier-minded members of the Borgia family for people they had a particular grudge against, so I chose them, and Mabel hopped it.
"Well," said Bingo rapturously. I took it that he wanted my opinion of the female poisoner who had just left us.
"Very nice," I said.
He seemed dissatisfied.
"You don't think she's the most wonderful girl you ever saw?" he said wistfully.
"Oh, absolutely," I said, to appease the blighter.
"Where did you meet her?"
"At a subscription dance at Camberwell."
"What on earth were you doing at a subscription dance at Camberwell?"
"Your man Jeeves asked me if I would buy a couple of tickets. It was in aid of some charity or other."
"Jeeves? I didn't know he went in for that sort of thing."
"Well, I suppose he has to relax a bit every now and then. Anyway, he was there, swinging a dashed efficient shoe. I hadn't meant to go at first, but I turned up for a lark. Oh, Bertie, think what I might have missed!"
"What might you have missed?" I asked, the old lemon being slightly clouded.
"Mabel, you chump! If I hadn't gone, I shouldn't have met Mabel. Oh, ah!"
At this point, Bingo fell into a species of trance, and only came out of it to wrap himself round the pie and macaroon.
"Bertie," he said, "I want your advice."
"Carry on."
"At least not your advice, because that wouldn't be much good to anybody. I mean, you're a pretty consummate old ass, aren't you? Not that I want to hurt your feelings, of course."
"No, no, I see that.
What I wish you would do is to put the whole thing to that fellow Jeeves of yours and see what he suggests. You've often told me that he has helped other pals of yours out of messes. From what you tell me, he's by way of being the brains of the family."
"He's never let me down yet."
"Then put my case to him."
"What case?"
"My problem."
"What problem?"
"Why, you poor fish, my uncle, of course. What do you think my uncle's going to say to all this? If I sprang it on him cold, he'd tie himself in knots on the hearthrug."
"One of these emotional Johnnies, eh?"
"Somehow or other, his mind has got to be prepared to receive the news. But how?"
"Ah."
"That's a lot of help, that ah. You see, I'm pretty well dependent on the old boy. If he cut off my allowance, I should be very much in the soup." "So you put the whole binge to Jeeves, and see if he can't scare up a happy ending somehow. Tell him my future is in his hands, and that if the wedding bells ring out, he can rely on me even unto half my kingdom. Well, call it 10 quid. Jeeves would exert himself with 10 quid on the horizon, what?"
"Undoubtedly," I said.
I wasn't in the least surprised at Bingo wanting to lug Jeeves into his private affairs like this. It was the first thing I would have thought of doing myself, if I had been in any hole of any description. As I have frequently had occasion to observe, he is a bird of the ripest intellect, full of bright ideas. If anybody could fix things for poor old Bingo, he could. I stated the case to him that night after dinner.
"Jeeves?"
"Sir?"
"Are you busy just now?"
"No, sir."
"I mean, not doing anything in particular?"
"No, sir. It is my practice at this hour to read some improving book. But if you desire my services, this can easily be postponed, or indeed abandoned altogether."
"Well, I want your advice. It's about Mr. Little."
"Young Mr. Little, sir, or the elder Mr. Little, his uncle, who lives in Pounceby Gardens?"
Jeeves seems to know everything. Most amazing thing. I'd been pally with Bingo practically all my life, and yet I didn't remember ever having heard that his uncle lived anywhere in particular.
"How did you know he lived in Pounceby Gardens?" I said.
"I'm on terms of some intimacy with the elder Mr. Little's cook, sir. In fact, there is an understanding."
I'm bound to say that this gave me a bit of a start. Somehow I'd never thought of Jeeves going in for that sort of thing.
"Do you mean you're engaged?"
"It may be said to amount to that, sir."
"Well, well."
"She is a remarkably excellent cook, sir," said Jeeves, as though he felt called on to give some explanation.
"What was it you wished to ask me about Mr. Little?"
I sprang the details on him.
"And that's how the matter stands, Jeeves," I said. "I think we ought to rally round a trifle and help poor old Bingo put the thing through. Tell me about old Mr. Little. What sort of a chap is he?"
"A somewhat curious character, sir. Since retiring from business he has become a great recluse, and now devotes himself almost entirely to the pleasures of the table."
"Greedy hog, you mean?"
I would not, perhaps, take the liberty of describing him in precisely those terms, sir. He is what is usually called a gourmet. Very particular about what he eats, and for that reason sets a high value on Miss Watson's services."
"The cook?"
"Yes, sir."
"Well, it looks to me as though our best plan would be to shoot young Bingo in on him after dinner one night. Melting mood, I mean to say, and all that."
"The difficulty is, sir, that at the moment Mr. Little is on a diet, owing to an attack of gout.
Things begin to look wobbly."
"No, sir. I fancy that the elder Mr. Little's misfortune may be turned to the younger Mr. Little's advantage. I was speaking only the other day to Mr. Little's valet, and he was telling me that it has become his principal duty to read to Mr. Little in the evenings. If I were in your place, sir, I would send young Mr. Little to read to his uncle."
"Nephew's devotion, you mean? Old man touched by kindly action, what?"
"Partly that, sir, but I would rely more on young Mr. Little's choice of literature."
"That's no good. Jolly old Bingo has a kind face, but when it comes to literature he stops at the Sporting Times."
"That difficulty may be overcome. I would be happy to select books for Mr. Little to read. Perhaps I might explain my idea further?"
"I can't say I quite grasp it yet."
"The method which I advocate is what, I believe, the advertisers call direct suggestion, sir, consisting as it does of driving an idea home by constant repetition. You may have had experience of the system?"
"You mean they keep on telling you that some soap or other is the best, and after a bit you come under the influence and charge round the corner and buy a cake?"
"Exactly, sir. The same method was the basis of all the most valuable propaganda during the recent war. I see no reason why it should not be adopted to bring about the desired result with regard to the subject's views on class distinctions."
"If young Mr. Little were to read day after day to his uncle a series of narratives in which marriage with young persons of an inferior social status was held up as both feasible and admirable, I fancy it would prepare the elder Mr. Little's mind for the reception of the information that his nephew wishes to marry a waitress in a tea-shop."
"Are there any books of that sort nowadays? The only ones I ever see mentioned in the papers are about married couples who find life grey and can't stick each other at any price."
"Yes, sir. There are a great many, neglected by the reviewers, but widely read."
"You have never encountered All for Love by Rosie M. Banks?"
"No."
"Nor A Red, Red Summer Rose by the same author?"
"No."
"I have an aunt, sir, who owns an almost complete set of Rosie M. Banks. I could easily borrow as many volumes as young Mr. Little might require. They make very light, attractive reading."
"Well, it's worth trying."
"I should certainly recommend the scheme, sir."
"All right, then. Toddle round to your aunt's tomorrow and grab a couple of the fruitiest. We can but have a dash at it."
"Precisely, sir."
End of chapter 1. Chapter 2 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P. G. Wodehouse. Chapter 2.
No wedding bells for Bingo.
Bingo reported 3 days later that Rosie M. Banks was the goods, and beyond a question, the stuff to give the troops. Old Little had jibbed somewhat at first at the proposed change of literary diet, he not being much of a lad for fiction, and having stuck hitherto exclusively to the heavier monthly reviews. But Bingo had got Chapter 1 of All for Love past his guard before he knew what was happening, and after that there was nothing to it. Since then they had finished A Red, Red Summer Rose, Madcap Myrtle, and Only a Factory Girl, and were halfway through The Courtship of Lord Strathmolec. Bingo told me all this in a husky voice over an egg beaten up in sherry. The only blot on the thing from his point of view was that it wasn't doing a bit of good to the old vocal cords, which were beginning to show signs of cracking under the strain. He had been looking his symptoms up in a medical dictionary, and he thought he had got clergyman's throat. But against this you had to set the fact that he was making an undoubted hit in the right quarter, and also that after the evening's reading he always stayed on to dinner. And from what he told me, the dinners turned out by old Little's cook had to be tasted to be believed. There were tears in the old blighter's eyes as he got on the subject of the clear soup. I suppose to a fellow who for weeks had been tackling macaroons and limado, it must have been like heaven. Old Little wasn't able to give any practical assistance at these banquets, but Bingo said that he came to the table and had his whack of arrowroot, and sniffed the dishes and told stories of entrees he had had in the past, and sketched out scenarios of what he was going to do to the bill of fare in the future, when the doctor put him in shape. So I suppose he enjoyed himself too, in a way. Anyhow, things seemed to be buzzing along quite satisfactorily, and Bingo said he had got an idea which he thought was going to clinch the thing. He wouldn't tell me what it was, but he said it was a pippin. "We make progress, Jeeves," I said. "That is very satisfactory, sir. Mr. Little tells me that when he came to the big scene in Only a Factory Girl, his uncle gulped like a stricken bullpup."
"Indeed, sir?"
"Where Lord Claude takes the girl in his arms, you know, and says—"
"I am familiar with the passage, sir. It is distinctly moving. It was a great favorite of my aunt's."
"I think we're on the right track."
"It would seem so, sir."
"In fact, this looks like being another of your successes. I've always said, and I always shall say, that for sheer brain, Jeeves, you stand alone. All the other great thinkers of the age are simply in the crowd watching you go by."
"Thank you very much, sir. I endeavor to give satisfaction."
About a week after this, Bingo blew in with the news that his uncle's gout had ceased to trouble him, and that on the morrow he would be back at the old stand working away with knife and fork as before. "And by the way," said Bingo, "he wants you to lunch with him tomorrow."
"Me? Why me? He doesn't know I exist."
"Oh, yes, he does. I've told him about you."
"What have you told him?"
"Oh, various things. Anyhow, he wants to meet you. And take my tip, laddie, you go. I should think lunch tomorrow would be something special." I don't know why it was, but even then it struck me that there was something dashed odd, almost sinister, if you know what I mean, about young Bingo's manner. The old egg had the air of one who has something up his sleeve.
"There is more in this than meets the eye," I said. "Why should your uncle ask a fellow to lunch whom he's never seen?"
"My dear old fathead, haven't I just said that I've been telling him all about you, that you're my best pal, at school together, and all that sort of thing?" "But even then—" "And another thing, why are you so dashed keen on my going?" Bingo hesitated for a moment. "Well, I told you I'd got an idea. This is it. I want you to spring the news on him. I haven't the nerve myself."
"What? I'm hanged if I do.
And you call yourself a pal of mine?"
"Yes, I know, but there are limits."
"Bertie," said Bingo reproachfully, "I saved your life once."
"When?"
"Didn't I? It must have been some other fellow then. Well, anyway, we were boys together and all that. You can't let me down."
"Oh, all right," I said. "But when you say you haven't nerve enough for any dashed thing in the world, you misjudge yourself.
a fellow who—"
"Cheerio," said young Bingo. 1:30 tomorrow. Don't be late."
I'm bound to say that the more I contemplated the binge, the less I liked it. It was all very well for Bingo to say that I was slated for a magnificent lunch, but what good is the best possible lunch to a fellow if he is slung out into the street on his ear during the soup course? However, the word of a Wooster is his bond and all that sort of rot, so at 1:30 next day I tottered up the steps of No. 16 Pounceby Gardens and punched the bell. And half a minute later I was up in the drawing-room, shaking hands with the fattest man I'd ever seen in my life. The motto of the Little family was evidently variety. Young Bingo is long and thin and hasn't had a superfluous ounce on him since we first met. But the uncle restored the average, and a bit over. The hand which grasped mine wrapped it round and enfolded it, till I began to wonder if I'd ever get it out without excavating machinery.
"Mr. Wooster, I am gratified. I am proud. I am honored."
It seemed to me that young Bingo must have boosted me to some purpose.
"Oh, ah," I said.
He stepped back a bit, still hanging on to the good right hand.
"You are very young to have accomplished so much."
I couldn't follow the train of thought. The family, especially my Aunt Agatha, who has savaged me incessantly from childhood up, have always rather made a point of the fact that mine is a wasted life, and that since I won the prize at my first school for the best collection of wildflowers made during the summer holidays, I haven't done a damn thing to land me on the nation's scroll of fame. I was wondering if he couldn't have got me mixed up with someone else when the telephone bell rang outside in the hall and the maid came in to say that I was wanted. I buzzed down and found it was young Bingo.
"Hello," said young Bingo. "So you've got there. Good man. I knew I could rely on you.
I say, old Crumpet, did my uncle seem pleased to see you?"
"Absolutely all over me. I can't make it out."
"Oh, that's all right. I just rang up to explain. The fact is, old man, I know you won't mind, but I told him that you were the author of those books I've been reading to him."
"What?"
"Yes, I said that Rosie M. Banks was your pen name, and you didn't want it generally known because you were a modest, retiring sort of chap. He'll listen to you now. Absolutely hang on your words. A brightish idea, what? I doubt if Jeeves in person could have thought up a better one than that. Well, pitch it strong, old lad, and keep steadily before you the fact that I must have my allowance raised. I can't possibly marry on what I've got now. If this film is to end with the slow fade-out on the embrace, at least double is indicated. Well, that's that. Cheerio." And he rang off. At that moment the gong sounded, and the genial host came tumbling downstairs like the delivery of a ton of coals. I always look back to that lunch with a sort of aching regret. It was the lunch of a lifetime, and I wasn't in a fit state to appreciate it. Subconsciously, if you know what I mean, I could see it was pretty special, but I had got the wind up to such a frightful extent over the ghastly situation in which young Bingo had landed me that its deeper meaning never really penetrated. Most of the time I might have been eating sawdust for all the good it did me. Old Little struck the literary note right from the start.
"My nephew has probably told you that I have been making a close study of your books of late," he began.
"Yes, he did mention it. How did you like the bally things?" He gazed reverently at me.
"Mr. Wooster, I am not ashamed to say that the tears came into my eyes as I listened to them. It amazes me that a man as young as you can have been able to plumb human nature so surely to its depths, to play with so unerring a hand on the quivering heartstrings of your reader, to write novels so true, so human, so moving, so vital."
"Oh, it's just a knack," I said. The good old persp was bedewing my forehead by this time in a pretty lavish manner. I don't know when I've been so rattled.
"Do you find the room a trifle warm?"
"Oh, no, no, rather not. Just right."
"Then it's the pepper. If my cook has a fault, which I am not prepared to admit,
it is that she is inclined to stress the pepper a trifle in her made dishes. By the way, do you like her cooking?" I was so relieved that we had got off the subject of my literary output that I shouted approval in a ringing baritone. "I am delighted to hear it, Mr. Wooster. I may be prejudiced, but to my mind that woman is a genius." "Absolutely," I said. "She has been with me 7 years, and in all that time I have not known her guilty of a single lapse from the highest standard, except once in the winter of 1917, when a purist might have condemned a certain mayonnaise of hers as lacking in creaminess. But one must make allowances. There had been several air raids about that time, and no doubt the poor woman was shaken. But nothing is perfect in this world, Mr. Wooster, and I have had my cross to bear. For 7 years I have lived in constant apprehension lest some evilly disposed person might lure her from my employment. To my certain knowledge she has received offers, lucrative offers, to accept service elsewhere. You may judge of my dismay, Mr. Wooster, when only this morning the bolt fell. She gave notice." "Good Lord!" "Your consternation does credit, if I may say so, to the heart of the author of A Red, Red Summer Rose. But I'm thankful to say the worst has not happened. The matter has been adjusted. Jane is not leaving me." "Good egg." "Good egg indeed, though the expression is not familiar to me. I do not remember having come across it in your books. And speaking of your books, may I say that what has impressed me about them even more than the moving poignancy of the actual narrative is your philosophy of life. If there were more men like you, Mr. Wooster, London would be a better place." This was dead opposite to my Aunt Agatha's philosophy of life, she having always rather given me to understand that it is the presence in it of chappies like me that makes London more or less of a plague spot, but I let it go. "Let me tell you, Mr. Wooster, that I appreciate your splendid defiance of the outworn fetishes of a purblind social system. I appreciate it. You are big enough to see that rank is but the guinea stamp, and that, in the magnificent words of Lord Bletchmore in Only a Factory Girl, be her origin ne'er so humble, a good woman is the equal of the finest lady on earth." I sat up. "I say, do you think that?" "I do, Mr. Wooster. I am ashamed to say that there was a time when I was like other men, a slave to the idiotic convention which we call class distinction. But since I read your books—" "I might have known it. Jeeves had done it again." "You think it's all right for a chappie in what you might call a certain social position to marry a girl of what you might describe as the lower classes?" "Most assuredly I do, Mr. Wooster." I took a deep breath and slipped him the good news. "Young Bingo, your nephew, you know, wants to marry a waitress," I said.
"Honor him for it," said old Little.
"You don't object?"
"On the contrary."
I took another deep breath and shifted to the sordid side of the business. "I hope you won't think I'm butting in, don't you know," I said. "But, well, how about it?" "I fear I do not quite follow you." "Well, I mean to say, his allowance and all that. The money you're good enough to give him. He was rather hoping that you might see your way to jerking up the total a bit." Old Little shook his head regretfully.
"I fear that can hardly be managed. You see, a man in my position is compelled to save every penny. I will gladly continue my nephew's existing allowance, but beyond that I cannot go. It would not be fair to my wife."
"What? But you're not married?"
"Not yet. But I propose to enter upon that holy state almost immediately. The lady who for years has cooked so well for me honored me by accepting my hand this very morning."
A cold gleam of triumph came into his eye.
"Now let him try to get her away from me," he muttered defiantly.
"A young Mr. Little has been trying frequently during the afternoon to reach you on the telephone, sir," said Jeeves that night when I got home.
"I'll bet he has," I said.
I had sent poor old Bingo an outline of the situation by messenger boy shortly after lunch. "He seemed a trifle agitated." "I don't wonder, Jeeves," I said,
so brace up and bite the bullet. I'm afraid I've bad news for you.
That scheme of yours, reading those books to old Mr. Little and all that, has blown out a fuse.
They did not soften him?
They did. That's the whole bally trouble.
Jeeves, I'm sorry to say that fiancée of yours, Miss Watson, you know, the cook, you know, well, the long and short of it is that she's chosen riches instead of honest worth, if you know what I mean.
Sir?
She's handed you the mitten and gone and got engaged to old Mr. Little.
Indeed, sir.
You don't seem much upset.
The fact is, sir, I had anticipated some such outcome.
I stared at him. Then what on earth did you suggest the scheme for?
To tell you the truth, sir, I was not wholly averse from a severance of my relations with Miss Watson. In fact, I greatly desired it. I respect Miss Watson exceedingly, but I have seen for a long time that we are not suited. Now, the other young person with whom I have an understanding—
Great Scott, Jeeves! There isn't another!
Yes, sir.
How long has this been going on?
For some weeks, sir. I was greatly attracted by her when I first met her at a subscription dance at Camberwell.
My sainted aunt, not—
Jeeves inclined his head gravely.
Yes, sir. By an odd coincidence, it is the same young person, that young Mr. Little. I have placed the cigarettes on the small table. Good night, sir.
End of chapter 2. Chapter 3 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P.G. Woodhouse. Chapter 3. Aunt Agatha Speaks Her Mind.
I suppose in the case of a chappie of really fine fibre and all that sort of thing, a certain amount of gloom and anguish would have followed this dishing of young Bingo's matrimonial plans. I mean, if mine had been a noble nature, I would have been all broken up. But what with one thing and another, I can't say I let it weigh on me very heavily. The fact that less than a week after he had had the bad news, I came upon young Bingo dancing like an untamed gazelle at Ciro's helped me to bear up. A resilient bird, Bingo. He may be down, but he is never out. While these little love affairs of his are actually on, nobody could be more earnest and blighted. But once the fuse has blown out, and the girl has handed him his hat and begged him as a favour never to let her see him again, up he bobs as merry and bright as ever. If I've seen it happen once, I've seen it happen a dozen times. So I didn't worry about Bingo, or about anything else, as a matter of fact. What with one thing and another, I can't remember ever having been chirpier than at about this period in my career. Everything seemed to be going right. On three separate occasions, horses on which I'd invested a sizable amount won by lengths instead of sitting down to rest in the middle of the race, as horses usually do when I've got money on them. Added to this, the weather continued topping to a degree. My new socks were admitted on all sides to be just the kind that Mother makes, and to round it all off, my Aunt Agatha had gone to France, and wouldn't be on hand to snooter me for at least another 6 weeks. And if you knew my Aunt Agatha, you'd agree that that alone was happiness enough for anyone. It suddenly struck me so forcibly, one morning while I was having my bath, that I hadn't a worry on earth, that I began to sing like a bally nightingale as I splashed the sponge about. It seemed to me that everything was absolutely for the best in the best of all possible worlds. But have you ever noticed a rummy thing about life? I mean, the way something always comes along to give it you in the neck at the very moment when you're feeling most braced about things in general. No sooner had I dried the old limbs and shoved on the suiting and toddled into the sitting room than the blow fell. There was a letter from Aunt Agatha on the mantelpiece.
"Oh, gosh," I said when I'd read it.
"Sir?" said Jeeves. He was fooling about in the background on some job or other. "It's from my Aunt Agatha, Jeeves. Mrs. Gregson, you know."
"Yes, sir."
"Ah, you wouldn't speak in that light, careless tone if you knew what was in it," I said with a hollow, mirthless laugh. "The curse has come upon us, Jeeves. She wants me to go and join her at—
What's the name of the dashed place? At Roville-sur-Mer. Oh, hang it all.
I had better be packing, sir.
I suppose so.
To people who don't know my Aunt Agatha, I find it extraordinarily difficult to explain why it is that she has always put the wind up me to such a frightful extent. I mean, I'm not dependent on her financially or anything like that. It's simply personality, I've come to the conclusion. You see, all through my childhood and when I was a kid at school, she was always able to turn me inside out with a single glance, and I haven't come out from under the fluence yet. We run to a height a bit in our family, and there's about 5'9" of Aunt Agatha, topped off with a beaky nose, an eagle eye, and a lot of gray hair, and the general effect is pretty formidable. Anyway, it never even occurred to me for a moment to give her the miss in balk on this occasion. If she said I must go to Roville, it was all over except buying the tickets. What's the idea, Jeeves? I wonder why she wants me.
I could not say, sir.
Well, it was no good talking about it. The only gleam of consolation, the only bit of blue among the clouds, was the fact that at Roville I should at last be able to wear the rather fruity cummerbund I had bought 6 months ago and had never had the nerve to put on. One of those silk contrivances, you know, which you tie round your waist instead of a waistcoat, something on the order of a sash, only more substantial. I had never been able to muster up the courage to put it on so far, for I knew that there would be trouble with Jeeves when I did, it being a pretty brightish scarlet. Still, at a place like Roville, presumably dripping with the gaiety and joie de vivre of France, it seemed to me that something might be done. Roville, which I reached early in the morning after a beastly choppy crossing and a jerky night in the train, is a fairly nifty spot where a chappie without encumbrances in the shape of aunts might spend a somewhat genial week or so. It is like all these French places, many sands and hotels and casinos. The hotel which had had the bad luck to draw Aunt Agatha's custom was the Splendide, and by the time I got there, there wasn't a member of the staff who didn't seem to be feeling it deeply. I sympathized with them. I've had experience of Aunt Agatha at hotels before. Of course, the real rough work was all over when I arrived, but I could tell by the way everyone groveled before her that she had started by having her first room changed because it hadn't a southern exposure, and her next because it had a creaking wardrobe, and that she had said her say on the subject of the cooking, the waiting, the chambermaiding, and everything else, with perfect freedom and candor. She had got the whole gang nicely under control by now. The manager, a whiskered cove who looked like a bandit, simply tied himself into knots whenever she looked at him. All this triumph had produced a sort of grim geniality in her, and she was almost motherly when we met. "I'm so glad you were able to come, Bertie," she said. "The air would do you so much good. Far better for you than spending your time in stuffy London nightclubs." "Oh, ah," I said. "You will meet some pleasant people, too. I want to introduce you to a Miss Hemingway and her brother, who have become great friends of mine. I am sure you will like Miss Hemingway. A nice, quiet girl, so different from so many of the bold girls one meets in London nowadays. Her brother is curate at Chipley in the Den in Dorsetshire. She tells me they are connected with the Kent Hemingways, a very good family. She is a charming girl." I had a grim foreboding of an awful doom. All this boosting was so unlike Aunt Agatha, who normally is one of the most celebrated right and left-hand knockers in London society. I felt a clammy suspicion, and by Jove, I was right. "Aileen Hemingway," said Aunt Agatha, "is just the girl I should like to see you marry, Bertie. You ought to be thinking of getting married. Marriage might make something of you. And I could not wish you a better wife than dear Aileen. She would be such a good influence in your life." "Here, I say," I chipped in at this juncture, chilled to the marrow. "Bertie," said Aunt Agatha, dropping the motherly manner for a bit and giving me the cold eye. "Yes, but I say, it is young men like you, Bertie, who make the person with the future of the race at heart despair.
cursed with too much money, you fritter away in idle selfishness a life which might have been made useful, helpful, and profitable. You do nothing but waste your time on frivolous pleasures. You are simply an antisocial animal, a drone. Bertie, it is imperative that you marry.
But dash it all.
Yes, you should be breeding children to—
No, really, I say please, I said, blushing richly.
Aunt Agatha belongs to two or three of these women's clubs, and she keeps forgetting she isn't in the smoking room.
Bertie, she resumed, and would no doubt have hauled up her slacks at some length, had we not been interrupted.
Ah, here they are, she said. Aileen, dear.
And I perceived a girl and a chappie bearing down on me, smiling in a pleased sort of manner.
I want you to meet my nephew Bertie Wooster, said Aunt Agatha. He has just arrived. Such a surprise! I had no notion that he intended coming to Roville.
I gave the couple the wary up and down, feeling rather like a cat in the middle of a lot of hounds. Sort of trapped feeling, you know what I mean. An inner voice was whispering that Bertram was up against it. The brother was a small round cove with a face rather like a sheep. He wore pince-nez, his expression was benevolent, and he had on one of those collars which button at the back.
"Welcome to Roville, Mr. Wooster," he said.
"Oh, Sydney," said the girl. "Doesn't Mr. Wooster remind you of Canon Blenkinsop, who came to Chipley to preach last Easter?"
"My dear, the resemblance is most striking."
They peered at me for a while, as if I was something in a glass case, and I goggled back and had a good look at the girl. There's no doubt about it, she was different from what Aunt Agatha had called the bold girls one meets in London nowadays. No bobbed hair and gaspers about her. I don't know when I've met anybody who looks so... respectable is the only word. She had on a kind of plain dress, and her hair was plain, and her face was sort of mild and saint-like. I don't pretend to be a Sherlock Holmes or anything of that order, but the moment I looked at her I said to myself, "The girl plays the organ in a village church." Well, we gazed at one another for a bit, and there was a certain amount of chit-chat, and then I tore myself away. But before I went, I had been booked up to take brother and the girl for a nice drive that afternoon, and the thought of it depressed me to such an extent that I felt there was only one thing to be done. I went straight back to my room, dug out the cummerbund, and draped it round the old tum. I turned round and Jeeves shied like a startled mustang.
"I beg your pardon, sir," he said in a sort of hushed voice. "You are surely not proposing to appear in public in that thing."
"The cummerbund," I said in a careless, debonair way, passing it off.
"Oh, rather!"
"I should not advise it, sir. Really, I shouldn't."
"Why not?"
"The effect, sir, is loud in the extreme."
I tackled the blighter squarely. "I mean to say, nobody knows better than I do that Jeeves is a mastermind and all that, but, dash it, a fellow must call his soul his own. You can't be a serf to your valet. Besides, I was feeling pretty low, and the cummerbund was the only thing which could cheer me up."
"You know the trouble with you, Jeeves," I said, "is that you're too—what's the word I want—too bally insular. You can't realize that you aren't in Piccadilly all the time. In a place like this, a bit of colour and touch of the poetic is expected of you. Why, I've just seen a fellow downstairs in a morning suit of yellow velvet."
"Nevertheless, sir—"
"Jeeves," I said firmly, "my mind is made up. I am feeling a little low-spirited and need cheering. Besides, what's wrong with it? This cummerbund seems to me to be called for. I consider that it has rather a Spanish effect, a touch of the Hidalgo. Sort of Vicente y Blasco—what's-his-name stuff. The jolly old Hidalgo off to the bullfight."
"Very good, sir," said Jeeves coldly.
Dashed upsetting, this sort of thing. If there's one thing that gives me the pip, it's unpleasantness in the home. And I could see that relations were going to be pretty fairly strained for a while. And coming on top of Aunt Agatha's bombshell about the Hemingway girl, I don't mind confessing, it made me feel more or less as though nobody loved me.
The drive that afternoon was about as mouldy as I had expected.
The curate chappie prattled on of this and that. The girl admired the view, and I got a headache early in the proceedings, which started at the soles of my feet and got worse all the way up. I tottered back to my room to dress for dinner, feeling like a toad under the harrow. If it hadn't been for that cummerbund business earlier in the day, I could have sobbed on Jeeves's neck and poured out all my troubles to him. Even as it was, I couldn't keep the thing entirely to myself. "I say, Jeeves," I said. "Sir?" "Mix me a stiffish brandy and soda." "Yes, sir." "Stiffish, Jeeves. Not too much soda, but splash the brandy about a bit." "Very good, sir." After imbibing, I felt a shade better. "Jeeves," I said.
"Sir?"
"I rather fancy I'm in the soup, Jeeves."
"Indeed, sir."
I eyed the man narrowly. Dashed aloof his manner was, still brooding over the cummerbund. "Yes, right up to the hocks," I said, suppressing the pride of the Woosters and trying to induce him to be a bit matier. "Have you seen a girl popping about here with a parson brother?"
"Miss Hemingway, sir?"
"Yes, sir." "Aunt Agatha wants me to marry her."
"Indeed, sir."
"Well, what about it?"
"Sir?"
"I mean, have you anything to suggest?"
"No, sir."
The blighter's manner was so cold and unchummy that I bit the bullet and had a dash at being airy. "Oh, well, tra-la-la," I said.
"Precisely, sir," said Jeeves.
And that was, so to speak, that. End of chapter 3.
Chapter 4 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P. G. Woodhouse. Chapter 4. Pearls Mean Tears. I remember, it must have been when I was at school, because I don't go in for that sort of thing very largely nowadays, reading a poem or something about something or other, in which there was a line which went, if I've got it rightly, "Shades of the prison house begin to close upon the growing boy." Well, what I'm driving at is that during the next 2 weeks that's exactly how it was with me. I mean to say, I could hear the wedding bells chiming faintly in the distance, and getting louder and louder every day, and how the deuce to slide out of it was more than I could think. Jeeves, no doubt, could have dug up a dozen brainy schemes in a couple of minutes, but he was still aloof and chilly, and I couldn't bring myself to ask him point blank. I mean, he could see easily enough that the young master was in a bad way, and if that wasn't enough to make him overlook the fact that I was still gleaming brightly about the waistband, well, what it amounted to was that the old feudal spirit was dead in the blighter's bosom, and there was nothing to be done about it. It really was rummy the way the Hemingway family had taken to me. I wouldn't have said offhand that there was anything particularly fascinating about me. In fact, most people look on me rather an ass. But there was no getting away from the fact that I went like a breeze with this girl and her brother. They didn't seem happy if they were away from me. I couldn't move a step, dash it, without one of them popping out from somewhere and freezing on. In fact, I'd got into the habit now of retiring to my room when I wanted to take it easy for a bit. I had managed to get a rather decent suite on the third floor, looking down onto the promenade. I had gone to earth in my suite one evening, and for the first time that day was feeling that life wasn't so bad after all. Right through the day from lunchtime I'd had the Hemingway girl on my hands, Aunt Agatha having shooed us off together immediately after the midday meal. The result was, as I looked down on the lighted promenade and saw all the people popping happily about on their way to dinner and the casino and what not, a kind of wistful feeling came over me. I couldn't help thinking how dashed happy I could have contrived to be in this place if only Aunt Agatha and the other blisters had been elsewhere. I heaved a sigh, and at that moment there was a knock at the door. "Someone at the door, Jeeves," I said.
"Yes, sir."
He opened the door, and in popped Aileen Hemingway and her brother, the last person I had expected. I really had thought that I could be alone for a minute in my own room. "Oh, hello," I said.
"Oh, Mr. Wooster," said the girl in a gasping sort of way. "I don't know how to begin."
Then I noticed that she appeared considerably rattled, and as for the brother,
He looked like a sheep with a secret sorrow. This made me sit up a bit and take notice. I had supposed that this was just a social call, but apparently something had happened to give them a jolt, though I couldn't see why they should come to me about it. "Is anything up?" I said.
"Poor Sidney! It was my fault. I ought never to have let him go there alone," said the girl, dashed agitated.
At this point, the brother, who, after shedding a floppy overcoat and parking his hat on a chair, had been standing by wrapped in the silence, gave a little cough, like a sheep caught in the mist on a mountain top.
"The fact is, Mr. Wooster," he said, "a sad, a most deplorable thing has occurred. This afternoon, while you were so kindly escorting my sister, I found the time hang a little heavy upon my hands, and I was tempted to, gamble at the casino."
I looked at the man in a kindlier spirit than I had been able to up to date. This evidence that he had sporting blood in his veins made him seem more human, I'm bound to say. If only I'd known earlier that he went in for that sort of thing, I felt that we might have had a better time together.
"Oh," I said, "did you click?"
He sighed heavily.
"If you mean was I successful, I must answer in the negative." I rashly persisted in the view that the color red, having appeared no fewer than 7 times in succession, must inevitably at no distant date give place to black. I was in error. I lost my little all, Mr. Wooster.
"Tough luck," I said.
"I left the casino," proceeded the chappie, "and returned to the hotel. There I encountered one of my parishioners, a Colonel Musgrave, who chanced to be holiday-making over here. I induced him to cash me a check for £100 on my little account in my London bank."
"Well, that was all to the good, what?" I said, hoping to induce the poor fish to look on the bright side. "I mean, bit of luck finding someone to slip it into first crack out of the box."
"On the contrary, Mr. Wooster, it did but make matters worse. I burned with shame as I made the confession, but I immediately went back to the casino and lost the entire sum, this time under the mistaken supposition that the color black was, as I believe the expression is, due for a run."
"I say," I said, "you are having a night out."
"And," concluded the chappie, "the most lamentable feature of the whole affair is that I have no funds in the bank to meet the check when presented."
I'm free to confess that, though I realized by this time that all this was leading up to a touch and that my ear was shortly going to be bitten in no uncertain manner, my heart warmed to the poor prune. Indeed, I gazed at him with no little interest and admiration. Never before had I encountered a curate so genuinely all to the mustard. Little as he might look like one of the lads of the village, he certainly appeared to be the real Tabasco, and I wished he had shown me this side of his character before.
"Colonel Musgrave," he went on, gulping somewhat, "is not a man who would likely to overlook the matter. He is a hard man. He will expose me to my vicar. My vicar is a hard man. In short, Mr. Wooster, if Colonel Musgrave presents that check, I shall be ruined. And he leaves for England tonight."
The girl, who had been standing by biting her handkerchief and gurgling at intervals while the brother got the above off his chest, now started in once more.
"Mr. Wooster," she cried, won't you help us? Oh, do say you will. We must have the money to get back the check from Colonel Musgrave before 9 o'clock. He leaves on the 9:20. I was at my wits' end what to do when I remembered how kind you had always been. Mr. Wooster, will you lend Sidney the money and take these as security?"
And before I knew what she was doing, she had dived into her bag, produced a case, and opened it.
"My pearls," she said. "I don't know what they're worth. They were a present from my poor father."
"Now, alas, no more," chipped in the brother.
"But I know they must be worth ever so much more than the amount we want."
Dashed embarrassing. Made me feel like a pawnbroker. More than a touch of popping the watch about the whole business. "No, I say really," I protested. "There's no need of any security, you know, or any rot of that kind. Only too glad to let you have the money.
I've got it on me, as a matter of fact. Rather luckily drew some this morning."
and I fished it out and pushed it across. The brother shook his head.
"Mr. Wooster," he said, "we appreciate your generosity, your beautiful, heartening confidence in us, but we cannot permit this."
"What Sidney means," said the girl, "is that you really don't know anything about us when you come to think of it. You mustn't risk lending all this money without any security at all to two people, who, after all, are almost strangers. If I hadn't thought that you would be quite businesslike about this, I would never have dared to come to you."
"The idea of, pledging the pearls at the local Monte Pieté was, you will readily understand, repugnant to us," said the brother.
"If you will just give me a receipt as a matter of form—"
"Oh, right-o."
I wrote out the receipt and handed it over, feeling more or less of an ass.
"Here you are," I said.
The girl took the piece of paper, shoved it in her bag, grabbed the money, and slipped it to Brother Sidney. And then, before I knew what was happening, she had darted at me, kissed me, and legged it from the room. I'm bound to say the thing rattled me. So dashed, sudden, and unexpected. I mean, a girl like that, always been quiet and demure and whatnot, by no means the sort of female you'd have expected to go about the place kissing fellows. Through a sort of mist I could see that Jeeves had appeared from the background and was helping the brother on with his coat. And I remember wondering idly how the dickens a man could bring himself to wear a coat like that, it being more like a sack than anything else. Then the brother came up to me and grasped my hand.
"I cannot thank you sufficiently, Mr. Wooster."
"Oh, not at all. You have saved my good name." "Good name in man or woman, dear my lord," he said, massaging the fin with some fervor, "is the immediate jewel of their souls. Who steals my purse steals trash. 'Twas mine, 'tis his, and has been slave to thousands. But he that filches from me my good name robs me of that which enriches not him, and makes me poor indeed. I thank you from the bottom of my heart. Good night, Mr. Wooster."
"Good night, old thing," I said.
I blinked at Jeeves as the door shut.
"Rather a sad affair, Jeeves," I said.
"Yes, sir."
"Lucky I happen to have all that money handy."
"Well, yes, sir."
"You speak as though you didn't think much of it."
"It is not my place to criticize your action, sir, but I will venture to say that I think you behaved a little rashly."
"What, lending that money?"
"Yes, sir.
These fashionable French watering places are notoriously infested by dishonest characters."
This was a bit too thick.
"Now look here, Jeeves," I said. "I can stand a lot, but when it comes to your casting whatever the word is on a bird in holy orders—"
"Perhaps I am over-suspicious, sir, but I have seen a great deal of these resorts. When I was in the employment of Lord Frederick Ranelagh, shortly before I entered your service, his lordship was very neatly swindled by a criminal known, I believe, by the sobriquet of Soapy Sid, who scraped acquaintance with us in Monte Carlo, with the assistance of a female accomplice. I have never forgotten the circumstances."
"I don't want to butt in on your reminiscences, Jeeves," I said coldly, "but you're talking through your hat. How can there have been anything fishy about this business? They've left me the pearls, haven't they? Very well, then. Think before you speak. You had better be tooling down to the desk now and having these things shoved in the hotel safe." I picked up the case and opened it. Oh, great Scott! The bally thing was empty.
"Oh, my lord," I said, staring, "don't tell me there's been dirty work at the crossroads after all."
"Precisely, sir. It was in exactly the same manner that Lord Frederick was swindled on the occasion to which I have alluded. While his female accomplice was gratefully embracing his lordship, Soapy Sid substituted a duplicate case for the one containing the pearls and went off with the jewels, the money, and the receipt. On the strength of the receipt, he subsequently demanded from his lordship the return of the pearls, and his lordship, not being able to produce them, was obliged to pay a heavy sum in compensation. It is a simple but effective ruse." I felt as if the bottom had dropped out of things with a jerk.
"Soapy Sid? Sid! Sidney! Brother Sidney! Why, by Jove, Jeeves, do you think that parson was Soapy Sid?"
"Yes, sir."
"But it seems so extraordinary. Why, his collar buttoned at the back. I mean, he would have deceived a bishop. Do you really think he was Soapy Sid?"
"Yes, sir.
I recognized him directly he came in the room. I stared at the blighter.
You recognized him?
Yes, sir.
Then dash it all, I said, deeply moved. I think you might have told me.
I thought it would save disturbance and unpleasantness if I merely abstracted the case from the man's pocket as I assisted him with his coat, sir. Here it is. He laid another case on the table beside the dud one, and, by Jove, you couldn't tell them apart. I opened it, and there were the good old pearls, as merry and bright as dammit, smiling up at me. I gazed feebly at the man. I was feeling a bit overwrought.
"Jeeves," I said, "you're an absolute genius."
"Yes, sir."
Relief was surging over me in great chunks by now. Thanks to Jeeves, I was not going to be called on to cough up several thousand quid.
"It looks to me as though you had saved the old home. I mean, even a chappie endowed with the immortal rind of dear old Sid is hardly likely to have the nerve to come back and retrieve these little chaps."
"I should imagine not, sir."
"Well, then. Oh, I say, you don't think they're just paste or anything like that?"
"No, sir. These are genuine pearls and extremely valuable."
"Well, then, dash it, I'm on velvet, absolutely reclining in the good old plush. I may be down 100 quid, but I'm up a jolly good string of pearls. Am I right or wrong?"
"Hardly that, sir. I think that you'll have to restore the pearls."
"What? To Sid? Not while I have my physique."
"No, sir, to their rightful owner."
"But who is their rightful owner?"
"Mrs. Gregson, sir."
"What? How do you know?"
"It was all over the hotel an hour ago that Mrs. Gregson's pearls had been abstracted. I was speaking to Mrs. Gregson's maid shortly before you came in, and she informed me that the manager of the hotel is now in Mrs. Gregson's suite."
"And having a devil of a time, what?"
"So I should be disposed to imagine, sir."
The situation was beginning to unfold before me. "I'll go and give them back to her, eh? It'll put me one up, what?"
"Precisely, sir, and if I may make the suggestion, I think it might be judicious to stress the fact that they were stolen by—"
"Great Scott! By the dashed girl she was hounding me on to marry, by Jove!"
"Exactly, sir."
"Jeeves," I said, "this is going to be the biggest score off my jolly old relative that has ever occurred in the world's history."
"It is not unlikely, sir."
"Keep her quiet for a bit, what? Make her stop snootering me for a while?"
"It should have that effect, sir."
"Golly," I said, bounding for the door.
Long before I reached Aunt Agatha's lair, I could tell that the hunt was up. Divers chappies in hotel uniform, and not a few chambermaids of sorts, were hanging about in the corridor, and through the panels I could hear a mixed assortment of voices, with Aunt Agatha's topping the lot. I knocked, but no one took any notice, so I trickled in. Among those present I noticed a chambermaid in hysterics, Aunt Agatha with her hair bristling, and the whiskered cove who looked like a bandit, the hotel manager fellow.
"Oh, hello," I said. "Hello, hello, hello."
Aunt Agatha shooshed me away. "No welcoming smile for Bertram."
"Don't bother me now, Bertie," she snapped, looking at me, if I were more or less the last straw.
"Something up?"
"Yes, yes, yes. I've lost my pearls."
"Pearls?
Pearls?
Pearls?" I said.
"No, really?
Dashed annoying. Where did you see them last?"
"What does it matter where I saw them last? They have been stolen."
Here Wilfred the Whisker King, who seemed to have been taking a rest between rounds, stepped into the ring again and began to talk rapidly in French. Cut to the quick, he seemed. The chambermaid whooped in the corner.
"Sure you've looked everywhere?" I said.
"Of course I've looked everywhere."
"Well, you know, I've often lost a collar stud, and—"
"Do try not to be so maddening, Bertie. I have enough to bear without your imbecilities. Oh, be quiet, be quiet!" she shouted in the sort of voice used by sergeant majors and those who call the cattle home across the sands of Dee.
And such was the magnetism of her forceful personality that Wilfred subsided as if he had run into a wall. The chambermaid continued to go strong.
"I say," I said, "I think there's something the matter with this girl. Isn't she crying or something? You may not have spotted it, but I'm rather quick at noticing things. She stole my pearls. I'm convinced of it." This started the whisker specialist off again, and in about a couple of minutes, Aunt Agatha had reached the frozen Grand Dame stage and was putting the last of the bandits through it in the voice she usually reserves for snubbing waiters in restaurants. "I tell you, my good man, for the 100th time—" "I say," I said, "don't want to interrupt you and all that sort of thing, but these aren't the little chaps by any chance, are they?" I pulled the pearls out of my pocket and held them up. "These look like pearls, what?" I don't know when I've had a more juicy moment. It was one of those occasions about which I shall prattle to my grandchildren, if I ever have any, which at the moment of going to press seems more or less of 100-to-1 shot. Aunt Agatha simply deflated before my eyes. It reminded me of when I once saw some chappies letting the gas out of a balloon. Where? She gurgled. "I got them from your friend, Miss Hemingway." Even now she didn't get it. "From Miss Hemingway? Miss Hemingway? But how did they come into her possession?" "How?" I said. "Because she jolly well stole them, pinched them, swiped them. Because that's how she makes her living, dash it, palling up to unsuspicious people in hotels and sneaking their jewelry. I don't know what her alias is, but her bally brother, the chap whose collar buttons at the back, is known in criminal circles as Soapy Sid." She blinked. "Miss Hemingway? A thief? I... She stopped and looked feebly at me. "But how did you manage to recover the pearls, Bertie dear?" "Never mind," I said crisply. "I have my methods." I dug out my entire stock of manly courage, breathed a short prayer, and let her have it right in the thorax. "I must say, Aunt Agatha, dash it all," I said severely, "I think you have been infernally careless. There's a printed notice in every bedroom in this place saying that there's a safe in the manager's office where jewelry and valuables ought to be placed, and you absolutely disregarded it. And what's the result? The first thief who came along simply walked into your room and pinched your pearls. And instead of admitting that it was all your fault, you started biting this poor man here in the gizzard. You have been very, very unjust to this poor man." "Yes, yes," moaned the poor man. "And this unfortunate girl, what about her? Where does she get off? You've accused her of stealing the things on absolutely no evidence. I think she would be jolly well advised to bring an action for whatever it is, and soak you for substantial damages." May we, c'est trop fort," shouted the bandit chief, backing me up like a good'un. And the chambermaid looked up inquiringly, as if the sun were breaking through the clouds. "I shall recompense her," said Aunt Agatha feebly. "If you take my tip, you jolly well will, and that eftsoons or right speedily. She's got a cast-iron case, and if I were her, I wouldn't take a penny under 20 quid. But what gives me the pip most is the way you've unjustly abused this poor man here and tried to give his hotel a bad name." "Yes, by damn, it's too bad," cried the whiskered marvel. "You careless old woman, you give my hotel bad names, would you, or wasn't it? Tomorrow you leave my hotel, by great Scotland." And more to the same effect, all good ripe stuff. And presently, having said his say, he withdrew, taking the chambermaid with him, the latter with a crisp tenner clutched in a vice-like grip. I suppose she and the bandit split it outside. A French hotel manager wouldn't be likely to let real money wander away from him without counting himself in on the division. I turned to Aunt Agatha, whose demeanour was now rather like that of one who, picking daisies on the railway, has just caught the down express in the small of the back. "I don't want to rub it in, Aunt Agatha," I said coldly, "but I should just like to point out before I go that the girl who stole your pearls is the girl you've been hounding me on to marry ever since I got here." "Good heavens! Do you realize that if you had brought the thing off, I should probably have had children who would have sneaked my watch while I was dandling them on my knee? I'm not a complaining sort of chap as a rule, but I must say that another time I do think you might be more careful how you go about egging me on to marry females." I gave her one look, turned on my heel, and left the room. 10 o'clock, a clear night, and all's well, Jeeves,' I said, breezing back into the good old suite. "'I am gratified to hear it, sir.' "'If 20 quid would be of any use to you, Jeeves?' "'I am much obliged, sir.' There was a pause, and then, well, it was a wrench, but I did it. I unstripped the cummerbund and handed it over. "'Do you wish me to press this, sir?' I gave the thing one last longing look. It had been very dear to me. "'No,' I said. "'Take it away. Give it to the deserving poor. I shall never wear it again.' "'Thank you very much, sir,' said Jeeves. End of chapter 4. Chapter 5 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P.G. Woodhouse. Chapter 5. The Pride of the Woosters is Wounded. If there's one thing I like, it's a quiet life. I'm not one of those fellows who get all restless and depressed if things aren't happening to them all the time. You can't make it too placid for me. Give me regular meals, a good show with decent music every now and then, and one or two pals to totter around with, and I ask no more. That is why the jar, when it came, was such a particularly nasty jar. I mean, I'd return from Rovia with a sort of feeling that from now on nothing could occur to upset me. Aunt Agatha, I imagine, would require at least a year to recover from the Hemingway affair, and apart from Aunt Agatha, there isn't anybody who really does much in the way of harrying me. It seemed to me that the skies were blue, so to speak, and no clouds in sight. I little thought. Well, look here, what happened was this. And I ask you if it wasn't enough to rattle anybody. Once a year, Jeeves takes a couple of weeks' vacation and biffs off to the sea or somewhere to restore his tissues. Pretty rotten from me, of course, while he's away, but it has to be stuck, so I stick it. And I must admit that he usually manages to get hold of a fairly decent fellow to look after me in his absence. Well, the time had come round again, and Jeeves was in the kitchen giving the understudy a few tips about his duties. I happened to want a stamp or something, and I toddled down the passage to ask him for it. The silly ass had left the kitchen door open, and I hadn't gone 2 steps when his voice caught me squarely in the eardrum. "'You will find, Mr. Wooster,' he was saying to the substitute chappie, "'an exceedingly pleasant and amiable young gentleman, but not intelligent. By no means intelligent. Mentally, he is negligible, quite negligible. Well, I mean to say, what? I suppose, strictly speaking, I ought to have charged in and ticked the blighter off properly in no uncertain voice. But I doubt whether it's humanly possible to tick Jeeves off. Personally, I didn't even have a dash at it. I merely called for my hat and stick in a marked manner and legged it. But the memory rankled, if you know what I mean. We Woosters don't lightly forget. At least we do, some things. Appointments and people's birthdays and letters to the post and all that, but not an absolutely bally insult like the above. I brooded like the dickens. I was still brooding when I dropped in at the oyster bar at Buck's for a quick bracer. I needed a bracer rather particularly at the moment, because I was on my way to lunch with Aunt Agatha. A pretty frightful ordeal, believe me, or believe me not, even though I took it that after what had happened at Roville, she would be in a fairly subdued and amiable mood. I had just had one quick and another rather slower, and was feeling about as cheerio as was possible under the circs, when a muffled voice hailed me from the northeast, and turning round, I saw young Bingo Little propped up in a corner, wrapping himself round a sizable chunk of bread and cheese. "'Hello, hello, hello,' I said. "'Haven't seen you for ages. "'You haven't been in here lately, have you?' "'No, I've been living out in the country.' "'Eh?' I said, for Bingo's loathing for the country was well known. "'Whereabouts?' "'Down in Hampshire, at a place called Dittridge.' "'No, really? I know some people who've got a house there. The Glossops. Have you met them?' "'Why, that's where I'm staying,' said young Bingo.' I'm tutoring the Glossop kid. What for? I said. I couldn't seem to see young Bingo as a tutor, though, of course, he did get a degree of sorts at Oxford, and I suppose you can always fool some of the people some of the time. What for? For money, of course. An absolute sitter came unstitched in the second race at Haydock Park, said young Bingo with some bitterness, and I dropped my entire month's allowance. I hadn't the nerve to touch my uncle for any more, so it was a case of buzzing around to the agents and getting a job. I've been down there 3 weeks. I haven't met the Glossop kid. Don't, advised Bingo briefly. The only one of the family I really know is the girl. I had hardly spoken these words when the most extraordinary change came over young Bingo's face. His eyes bulged, his cheeks flushed, and his Adam's apple hopped about like one of those India rubber balls on the top of the fountain in a shooting gallery. "Oh, Bertie," he said in a strangled sort of voice. I looked at the poor fish anxiously. I knew that he was always falling in love with someone, but it didn't seem possible that even he could have fallen in love with Honoria Glossop. To me, the girl was simply nothing more nor less than a pot of poison. One of those dashed, large, brainy, strenuous, dynamic girls you see so many of these days. She had been at Girton, where, in addition to enlarging her brain to the most frightful extent, she had gone in for every kind of sport and developed the physique of a middleweight, catch-as-catch-can wrestler. I'm not sure she didn't box for the varsity when she was up. The effect she had on me whenever she appeared was to make me want to slide into a cellar and lie low till they blew the all clear. Yet here was young Bingo, obviously all for her. There was no mistaking it. The love light was in the blighter's eyes. "I worship her, Bertie. I worship the very ground she treads on," continued the patient in a loud, penetrating voice. Fred Thompson and one or two fellows had come in, and McGarry, the chappie behind the bar, was listening with his ears flapping. But there's no reticence about Bingo. He always reminds me of the hero of a music comedy who takes the center of the stage, gathers the boys around him in a circle, and tells them all about his love at the top of his voice. "Have you told her?" "No, I haven't had the nerve. But we walk together in the garden most evenings, and it sometimes seems to me that there is a look in her eyes. I know that look, like a sergeant major. Nothing of the kind, like a tender goddess." "Half a second, old thing," I said. "Are you sure we're talking about the same girl? The one I mean is Honoria. Perhaps there's a younger sister or something I've not heard of." "Her name is Honoria," bawled Bingo reverently. "And she strikes you as a tender goddess?" "She does." "God bless you," I said. "She walks in beauty like the night of cloudless climes and starry skies, and all that's best of dark and bright meet in her aspect and her eyes." "Another bit of bread and cheese," he said to the lad behind the bar. "You're keeping your strength up," I said. "This is my lunch. I've got to meet Oswald at Waterloo at 1:15 to catch the train back. I brought him up to town to see the dentist." "Oswald? Is that the kid?" "Yes. Pestilential to a degree." "Pestilential? That reminds me, I'm lunching with my Aunt Agatha. I'll have to pop off now, or I'll be late." I hadn't seen Aunt Agatha since that little affair of the pearls, and while I didn't anticipate any great pleasure from gnawing a bone in her society, I must say that there was one topic of conversation I felt pretty confident she wouldn't touch on, and that was the subject of my matrimonial future. I mean, when a woman's made a bloomer like the one Aunt Agatha made at Roville, you'd naturally think that a decent shame would keep her off it for, at any rate, a month or two. But women beat me. I mean to say, as regards nerve. You'll hardly credit it, but she actually started in on me with the fish. Absolutely with the fish, I give you my solemn word. We'd hardly exchanged a word about the weather when she let me have it without a blush. "Bertie," she said, "I've been thinking again about you and how necessary it is that you should get married." I quite admit that I was dreadfully mistaken in my opinion of that terrible hypocritical girl at Roville, but this time there is no danger of an error. By great good luck, I have found the very wife for you, a girl whom I have only recently met, but whose family is above suspicion. She has plenty of money, too, though that does not matter in your case. The great point is that she is strong, self-reliant, and sensible, and will counterbalance the deficiencies and weaknesses of your character. She has met you, and while there is naturally much in you of which she disapproves, she does not dislike you. I know this, for I have sounded her, guardedly, of course, and I am sure that you have only to make the first advances. Who is it? I would have said it long before, but the shock had made me swallow a bit of roll the wrong way, and I had only just finished turning purple and trying to get a bit of air back into the old windpipe. Who is it? Sir Roderick Glossop's daughter, Honoria. No, no, I cried, paling beneath the tan. Don't be silly, Bertie. She is just the wife for you. Yes, but look here. She will mould you. But I don't want to be moulded. Aunt Agatha gave me the kind of look she used to give me when I was a kid and had been found in the jam cupboard. Bertie, I hope you are not going to be troublesome. Well, but I mean, Lady Glossop has very kindly invited you to Dittridge Hall for a few days. I told her you would be delighted to come down tomorrow. I'm sorry, but I've got a dashed important engagement tomorrow. What engagement? Well, you have no engagement, and even if you had, you must put it off. I shall be very seriously annoyed, Bertie, if you do not go to Dittridge Hall tomorrow. Oh, righto, I said. It wasn't 2 minutes after I'd parted from Aunt Agatha before the old fighting spirit of the Woosters reasserted itself. Ghastly as the peril was which loomed before me, I was conscious of a rummy sort of exhilaration. It was a tight corner, but the tighter the corner, I felt, the more juicily should I score off Jeeves when I got myself out of it without a bit of help from him. Ordinarily, of course, I should have consulted him and trusted to him to solve the difficulty, but after what I had heard him saying in the kitchen, I was dashed if I was going to demean myself. When I got home, I addressed the man with light abandon. "Jeeves," I said, "I'm in a bit of a difficulty." "I'm sorry to hear that, sir." "Yes, quite a bad hole. In fact, you might say on the brink of a precipice and faced by an awful doom." "If I could be of any assistance, sir." "Oh, no, no, no. Thanks very much, but no, no, I won't trouble you. I've no doubt I shall be able to get out of it all right by myself." "Very good, sir." So that was that. I'm bound to say that I'd have welcomed a bit more curiosity from the fellow, but that is Jeeves all over. Cloaks his emotions, if you know what I mean. Honoria was away when I got to Dittridge on the following afternoon. Her mother told me that she was staying with some people named Braithwaite in the neighborhood, and would be back next day, bringing the daughter of the house with her for a visit. She said I would find Oswald out in the grounds, and such is a mother's love that she spoke as if that were a bit of a boost for the grounds and an inducement to go there. Rather decent, the grounds at Dittridge. A couple of terraces, a bit of lawn with a cedar on it, a bit of shrubbery, and finally a small but goodish lake with a stone bridge running across it. Directly I'd worked my way round the shrubbery, I spotted young Bingo leaning against the bridge smoking a cigarette. Sitting on the stonework, fishing, was a species of kid whom I took to be Oswald, the plague spot. Bingo was both surprised and delighted to see me, and introduced me to the kid. If the latter was surprised and delighted too, he concealed it like a diplomat. He just looked at me, raised his eyebrows slightly, and went on fishing. He was one of those supercilious striplings who give you the impression that you went to the wrong school and that your clothes don't fit. "This is Oswald," said Bingo. "What?" I replied cordially. "Could be sweeter. How are you?" "Oh, all right," said the kid. "Nice place, this." "Oh, all right," said the kid. "Having a good time fishing?" "Oh, all right," said the kid. Young Bingo led me off to commune apart. "Doesn't jolly old Oswald's incessant flow of prattle make your head ache sometimes?" I asked. Bingo sighed. "It's a hard job." "What's a hard job?" "Loving him." "Do you love him?" I asked, surprised. I shouldn't have thought it could be done.
I try to, said young Bingo, for her sake. She's coming back tomorrow, Bertie.
So I heard.
She is coming, my love, my own.
Absolutely, I said. But touching on young Oswald once more, do you have to be with him all day? How do you manage to stick it?
Oh, he doesn't give much trouble.
When we aren't working, he sits on that bridge all the time, trying to catch tiddlers.
Why don't you shove him in?
Shove him in? It seems to me distinctly the thing to do, I said, regarding the stripling's back with a good deal of dislike.
It would wake him up a bit, and make him take an interest in things.
Bingo shook his head a bit wistfully.
Your proposition attracts me, he said, but I'm afraid it can't be done. You see, she would never forgive me. She is devoted to the little brute.
Great Scott! I cried. I've got it!
I don't know if you know that feeling when you get an inspiration and tingle all down your spine from the soft collar as now worn to the very soles of the old Waukeeses. Jeeves, I suppose, feels that way more or less all the time, but it isn't often it comes to me. But now all nature seemed to be shouting at me, "You've clicked!" And I grabbed young Bingo by the arm in a way that must have made him feel as if a horse had bitten him. His finely chiseled features were twisted with agony and whatnot, and he asked me what the dickens I thought I was playing at.
"Bingo," I said, "what would Jeeves have done?"
"How do you mean, what would Jeeves have done?"
"I mean, what would he have advised in a case like yours? I mean, you wanting to make a hit with Honoria Glossop and all that."
"Why, take it from me, laddie. He would have shoved you behind that clump of bushes over there. He would have got me to lure Honoria onto the bridge somehow. Then, at the proper time, he would have told me to give the kid a pretty hefty jab in the small of the back, so as to shoot him into the water. And then you would have dived in and hauled him out. How about it?"
"You didn't think that out by yourself, Bertie," said young Bingo, in a hushed sort of voice.
"Yes, I did. Jeeves isn't the only fellow with ideas.
But it's absolutely wonderful. Just a suggestion.
The only objection I can see is that it would be so dashed awkward for you. I mean to say, suppose the kid turned round and said you had shoved him in. That would make you frightfully unpopular with her."
"I don't mind risking that."
The man was deeply moved.
"Bertie, this is noble."
"No, no."
He clasped my hand silently, then chuckled like the last drop of water going down the waste-pipe in a bath.
"Now what?" I said.
"I was only thinking," said young Bingo, "how fearfully wet Oswald will get. Oh, happy day!"
End of chapter 5.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.